Hello, this is Linda Lover, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from today's issue of the Toronto Star and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Stay with me, brother. When Brijesh Patel was having a heart attack, he called out to strangers from a bench on a downtown street. Only one man stopped to help. When Brijesh Patel suffered a heart attack on his way home from his Liberty Village fitness class one September evening, he said six people ignored his pleas for help before a man finally stopped to help him call an ambulance. After weeks spent searching on social media for his savior, the 44-year-old Toronto entrepreneur said he finally reconnected with the man on Thursday afternoon. He was just like, "Look, I was just doing what any human would have done," Patel said of the man, who wished to remain anonymous. "I told him thank you, but he was like, 'You don't have to say thank you to me.'" Patel hopes his experience might serve as a cautionary tale for people to slow down and listen when someone is asking for help. "I think the greatest thing that humans can do is be of service to each other," he said. "We're all human, right? It doesn't cost anything to call 911. Patel said he first noticed something was off during his evening fitness class on September 16th. He was sweating more than usual and felt a slight tightness in his chest. Thinking little of it at first, Patel carried on, finishing his class and gulping down a smoothie as he walked home. But the pain never went away. "Something told me, don't go home alone because I live alone in a condo," he said. "Something told me to sit on this bench outside in case you need someone to help you." As soon as he sat down, Patel's symptoms suddenly intensified. He began sweating like crazy and was overcome by a wave of nausea. His chest pains got worse and his right hand began tingling. Panicking, Patel tried to wave at the two women sitting on the next bench over. As they got up and walked by his bench, Patel said he cried out for help, asking them to call an ambulance. "One girl kept walking by me. The other girl, I heard her say, 'Oh yeah, I'm calling an ambulance.' And I kind of looked at her like, I don't think she's calling an ambulance because she's not stopping." After watching the two walk away, Patel tried to get the attention of a passing group of four, but they ignored his cries. As he felt the frustration bubble inside him, Patel said he saw the man park his car nearby. The stranger rushed over after hearing Patel's pleas for help, only to say that his phone was dead. It was then that Patel realized he had his own phone on him, something he'd forgotten in his shock. "Just that man responding back to me was enough to get me out of my freeze," he said. Patel now dialed 911 on his own and requested an ambulance, but blanked when they asked for his location. That's when the stranger sprinted across the street into a nearby pizza store, returning with the correct address. With the ambulance on the way, Patel leaned over and vomited. As he swayed back and forth, he heard the stranger say, "Stay with me, brother. I can hear the sirens. They're close," Patel said. The man remained with Patel and comforted him over the 7 minutes it took the ambulance to arrive. Then he disappeared as Patel was rushed to Toronto General Hospital. In the intensive care unit, Patel remembers asking a doctor if he was going to die. "I can't die today. It's my sister's birthday," he recalls saying. He wouldn't die that day. Doctors discovered a blockage in one of his coronary arteries affecting blood flow to his heart. As soon as they inserted a stent in his chest, Patel said he felt this massive relief. "I'm pretty sure I told the doctor I loved him when that happened." Patel said he woke up in the ICU without any major damage to his heart. He tried to track the stranger down, asking the Pie Company pizza store across the street for their surveillance footage of the man, which his sister Sejal shared on Instagram Wednesday evening. Other accounts soon picked up the story, with some posts gaining over 700,000 views. The very next day, Patel received a message from the stranger and gave him a call. "He was empathetic and sensitive," said Sejal, who noted the person understood why passersby might be hesitant to help. He said, "I'm a bigger dude. I'm not threatened by someone asking for help. A woman might feel a different way, especially in that neighborhood." Patel reasoned the people who ignored him might have also assumed he was homeless or high on drugs, but said that was no reason to ignore someone in need. "If someone asks for help, help them," he said. "You can just call 911. You don't have to talk to them. You don't have to touch them." Patel hopes to buy the man a beer once he returns from vacation next week, as well as a charger for his dead phone. K-pop pop-up delights fans. P1 Harmony performs at park after show in city was postponed. K-pop group P1 Harmony was forced to postpone their Toronto show just hours before they were scheduled to perform due to a system outage at the Canadian border that caused significant delays. The concert, originally set for Wednesday night at Coca-Cola Coliseum, has been rescheduled for October 7th at 8 p.m. The arena confirmed on Instagram it was unavoidably postponed due to a system outage at the Canada-U.S. border, tour producer Hello82 said in a statement on Instagram. The show was called off Wednesday morning. The updated date and time were announced that afternoon. The promoter said all purchased tickets and VIP packages will remain valid. Fans seeking refunds are advised to contact their point of purchase directly. But it wasn't all bad news for P1 Harmony fans. Later that day, the six-member group, led by Mark Hamborn, Steven, Kiho Yoon, posted that they were heading to Trinity Bellwoods Park in downtown Toronto. The pop-up appearance delighted fans who gathered to see them, with many sharing joyful moments from the park on social media. P1 Harmony debuted in October 2020. Their 2024 album, Killin' It, hit number one on the Korean and Billboard U.S. World charts. The outage at the Canada-U.S. border caused difficulties and delays for commercial trucks Tuesday. It began at about 10:15 a.m. that day. On Tuesday evening, Canada Border Services Agency said the issue had been resolved. Canada is making some progress in trade talks with U.S., LeBlanc says. Canada is making progress in talks to reach a breakthrough on tariffs imposed by U.S. President Donald Trump, according to Prime Minister Mark Carney's point man in the trade war. Dominic LeBlanc, the minister responsible for Canada-U.S. trade told a Senate committee Thursday that the focus of talks between him, Ambassador Kirsten Hillman, and their U.S. counterparts right now is on sector-specific tariffs that Trump has applied, citing national security concerns on foreign-made automobiles, steel, and aluminum, which have hit Canadian producers hard. Meanwhile, the Canadian and U.S. governments are consulting more broadly ahead of next year's scheduled review of the Canada-United States-Mexico agreement. LeBlanc hinted that things are going well, all while offering no details. "We're taking the time necessary to secure what, in our judgment, might be a good deal for the Canadian economy. We're making progress. We're not there yet," he told senators. Asked what specifically he meant by progress, LeBlanc later told the Star he's having continued detailed conversations that are more detailed conversations than previous ones, but he declined to clarify further after appearing in an afternoon Commons committee. However, in the eyes of representatives of Canadian aluminum and steel producers, it's hard to see any progress as the details are closely guarded secrets. Catherine Cobden, head of the Canadian Steel Producers Association, said the dispute is being managed government to government with little participation by the industry. "So I do think getting the read from Dominic LeBlanc is important. But, she said, the most important thing for us is that there is retaliation reinstated. Canada largely dropped or watered down many of its counter-tariffs since first retaliating last winter against Trump's punitive levies on imports. In the case of steel, the industry would like Carney to reinstate measures against American steel imports, if not to the 50% tariffs Trump has imposed, then at least back to the previous 25% counter-tariffs Canada had adopted before issuing certain exemptions in the spring. For now, Cobden said, the industry is putting most of its efforts into making sure Canada's domestic steel market isn't flooded by cheap steel imports from China and other countries who are also trying to find buyers for their steel in light of American tariffs. Cobden said Canadian steelmakers are really pivoting to what we can control, given that for steel in particular, Trump's Section 232 tariff has been in place since March, and there's been no progress. It's a long haul, said Jean Simard, head of the Aluminum Association of Canada. There seems to be more and better understanding of the real issues related to reaching the goals of the U.S. administration, a required step toward eventually getting to a negotiated outcome, but we are not there yet. In fact, despite months of talks between LeBlanc and Trump's officials and Carney's ongoing texts and calls with the U.S. president, he spoke to Trump as recently as last week in New York City, Trump has still levied even more punitive tariffs on softwood, hardwood, and finished lumber products such as furniture and cabinets. Those affect Canadian producers who were already reeling under increased countervailing duties imposed last fall. Trump has further threatened to penalize foreign-made brand pharmaceuticals at 100% and foreign films, but he has not yet signed executive orders to execute those threats. Carney declined Thursday to answer a star question about whether he will retaliate or respond to the latest round of tariffs. LeBlanc also sidestepped that question. He stated categorically to both parliamentary committees Thursday that Canada will not renegotiate the tariff quota rates under CUSMA that apply to supply-managed agriculture sectors like the dairy industry. He told MPs that the government felt counter-tariffs were not helping to advance the negotiation. Meanwhile, he said he thinks that senior Republicans, border state governors, and politicians, and American business leaders and sectoral groups are privately telling the American administration that the current tariff pressures are not in their own economic interests. Conservative international trade critic Adam Chambers told LeBlanc the opposition wants him to succeed in resolving the trade dispute and offered whatever support his party could to those efforts. Budget cutbacks put justice at risk, feds told. With legal groups voicing concerns about delays and backlogs, the agency that administers federal courts is warning core services are at risk from a lack of funding. The warning is included in the Courts Administration Services annual departmental plan that was published this summer and comes ahead of the Liberal government's first budget, which Prime Minister Mark Carney has said will mix austerity with investment in areas like housing and national defense. The plan projects that without additional funding from government, annual spending at the agency will drop from about $208 million this year to around $125 million in 2027 and 28. As it stands, the agency reported there is a risk that financial resources will be inadequate to deliver on CAS's core mandate. This will likely directly impact court operations, the plan says, including the agency's ability to maintain acceptable service levels. The plan cites delays and backlogs for services like processing files and scheduling cases as possible impacts and warns that efforts to digitally modernize federal courts could also be affected. The projected drop comes as the federal government presses ahead with a review of spending in which almost all federal departments and agencies have been asked to find savings that total $25 billion over the next 3 years. At the same time, with tax cuts and increased funding for the military and other liberal initiatives, the Independent Parliamentary Budget Officer predicted last week that the federal budget deficit will increase from $51.7 billion last year to $68.5 billion, a change that raises concerns about the long-term sustainability of current fiscal policy. In an emailed statement, Lola Dandy-Beva, a spokesperson for Federal Justice Minister Sean Fraser, did not answer questions about the agency's funding issues. She also didn't say whether any new funding will come in the November 4th budget. We will continue to engage with the courts as part of broader discussions on supporting access to justice, Dandy-Beva said. In a letter to the Federal Finance Department dated August 28th, the Canadian Bar Association noted the government's efforts to rein in spending, but argued ensuring effective courts is essential to maintaining confidence in the institutions that uphold the rule of law. We recognize the significant fiscal pressures facing Canada and acknowledge the government's commitment to responsible spending. At the same time, courts occupy a unique role within our constitutional framework, the letter said, calling for stable multi-year funding for the federal courts service. The Canadian Judicial Council has also expressed concerns about funding to federal courts, describing it in a statement to the Star this week as a matter of respect for judicial independence and essential to ensuring meaningful access to justice. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Charlotte MacDonald, a lawyer at Gowling WLG and chair of the intellectual property section at the Canadian Bar Association, said concerns about funding and its impact on federal court services have persisted for years. Services like English-French translation, delays in scheduling, and efforts to digitize court services have all been affected, MacDonald said. In March, the Federal Court Registry, part of the system overseen by the Court's Administrative Service, sent a notice to lawyers that said a significant surge in court filings meant processing times would increase from 48 hours to up to 4 weeks. Later in the spring, the court highlighted an unprecedented increase in filings from immigration cases, with a volume in 2024 that quadrupled the average caseload over the previous 5 years. Citing budget reductions and insufficient resources, the court's Chief Justice, Paul Crampton, said the system could no longer process the files on a timely basis and made an order to give applicants an additional 45 days to make filings without impacting their cases. Statistics published by the federal court show the annual number of new immigration cases increased 300% from 7,782 in 2019 to 24,667 in 2024. Halfway through this year, another 14,514 immigration cases were started. The overall picture is that the backlog of pending cases in federal court increased from 6,301 at the end of 2019 to 20,797 at the end of June 2025. In its letter to the Finance Department, the Canadian Bar Association said a significant proportion of this backlog is from policies such as immigration officials not always providing reasons for their decisions, prompting applicants to turn to the courts. But a lot of it also comes down to funding, said MacDonald, who argued court services don't have enough money to hire the workers they need to handle the caseload and fulfill their mandate. The impact can also be seen in other areas where federal courts have jurisdiction, she said, including tax cases, indigenous law, and intellectual property. Justice delayed is justice denied, she said. Delays cost people time, which really impacts people's lives. That's what it comes down to. Terror attack. Two killed as man targets UK synagogue on Yom Kippur. An assailant drove a car into people outside a synagogue Thursday in northern England and then began stabbing them, killing two and seriously hurting at least three in what people call a terrorist attack on the holiest day of the Jewish year. Officers shot and killed the suspect at the synagogue in Manchester, police said, though authorities took some time to confirm he was dead because he was wearing a vest that made it appear as if he had explosives. Police later said he did not have a bomb. The Metropolitan Police Force in London, which leads the nation's counterterrorism policing operations, declared the rampage a terrorist attack. Authorities said the man believed responsible was a 35-year-old British citizen of Syrian descent named Jihad al-Shami, who entered the UK as a young child and became a citizen in 2006. An initial check of records showed he was not part of a UK counter-terror program that tries to identify people at risk for being radicalized. Police said three people were arrested on suspicion of acts of terrorism. They are two men in their 30s and a woman in her 60s. Authorities were working to formally identify the dead and determine the motive for the attack. At least three people were hospitalized in serious condition, officials said. One person sustained a stab wound while a second was struck by the car involved in the attack. A third person arrived at a hospital with an injury that may have been sustained as officers stopped the attacker. Earlier, police said a fourth individual had also been hurt. The assault took place as people gathered at an Orthodox synagogue in an outer neighborhood of Manchester on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement and the most solemn day in the Jewish calendar. People said the two people killed were Jewish. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer denounced the vile assailant who attacked Jews because they are Jews. He promised the Jewish community that he would do everything in my power to guarantee you the security that you deserve, starting with a more visible police presence. I promise you that over the coming days you will see the other Britain, the Britain of compassion, of decency, of love, Starmer said. I promise you that this Britain will come together to wrap our arms around your community and show you that Britain is a place where you and your family are safe, secure, and belong. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel grieved with the Jewish community in the UK. Our hearts are with the families of the murdered, and we pray for the swift recovery of the wounded, he said. As I warned at the UN, weakness in the face of terrorism only brings more terrorism. Only strength and unity can defeat it. Anti-Semitic incidents in the UK have hit record levels following Hamas' October 7, 2023 attack on Israel and Israel's ensuing military campaign in Gaza, according to Community Security Trust, an advocacy group for British Jews that works to eliminate anti-Semitism. More than 1,500 incidents were reported in the first half of the year, the second highest six-month total reported since the record set over the same period a year earlier. This is every rabbi's or every Jewish person's worst nightmare, said Rabbi Jonathan Romaine of Maidenhead Synagogue and head of the Rabbinic Court of Great Britain. Not only is this a sacred day, the most sacred in the Jewish calendar, but it's also a time of mass gathering. Series set. Blue Jays to host Yankees Saturday in playoff battle. Just about every Blue Jays fan has a favorite era. Maybe it's the 1980s when George Bell, Lloyd Mosby, and Jesse Barfield patrolled the outfield and right-hander Dave Steeb dominated like few others could. Or the 90s when Joe Carter, Roberto Alomar, John Olerud, and Devon White became nationwide stars. In the 2000s, there were individual greatness, there was individual greatness in Roy Halladay and Carlos Delgado, but not enough teams wins to justify much love. Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, and Josh Donaldson were then among those who snapped the 22-year postseason drought in 2015 and along the way created a whole new army of supporters. The younger generation might have been won over by the current era. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, and George Springer are among those who led the Jays to the playoffs four times in the last 6 years. They've yet to have success once there, but have another chance on Saturday when the American League Division Series gets underway at the Rogers Center. The question is, how do these eras stack up against each other? Which team had the best lineup, starting rotation, and bullpen? To help answer that question, the Star examined a selection of traditional and advanced stats that helped compare all 11 of the Jays' postseason teams to see which one stood out the most. The offense. The gold standard when talking about Blue Jays' bats was a 1993 team. After all, the order was filled with a who's who of elite hitters. Five position players made the All-Star team, and the lineup featured future Hall of Famers Alomar, Paul Molitor, and for a couple of months, Ricky Henderson, Carter White, and batting champ Olerud weren't too shabby either. Then the 2015 team came along with American League MVP Donaldson, Bautista, and Encarnacion combining for 120 home runs, leading a team that was a nightmare for opposing pitchers, especially in the last 2 months. The numbers show that the 2015 roster had the edge over 93 in runs per game, 5.5 to 5.2, and five Jays playoff qualifiers hit more home runs than the 93 team, which ranks first among those teams with a .279 batting average. The advanced stats tell a similar story. OPS Plus takes a player's on-base plus slugging percentage and tries to normalize it across the league by accounting for external factors such as ballparks. Ditto for weighted runs created plus WRC plus. Both are then adjusted so that 100 is league average. The 93 team is third in OPS plus 110 and fourth in WRC plus 109. This year's version of the Jays stacks up well compared to those that came before. Their 4.9 runs per game trail only 2015 and 1993, while somewhat surprisingly, their 1.2 homers per game are tied for third. The current squad's 112 WRC plus is third, and their 108 OPS plus is tied for fourth. The biggest strength of the 2025 lineup has been an ability to consistently put balls in play. Their 1,099 strikeouts were their fewest in a full season since 2009, and only the Kansas City Royals struck out less this season. In fact, they don't strike out. The fact they don't strike out is really frustrating, Jays right-hander Kevin Gausman said. As a pitcher, you make so many good pitches, and they just keep falling them off. You're going to make a mistake eventually, and these guys feast on that mistake. They fall off good pitches until they get it. Even so, it's that magical 2015 team that arguably had the best lineup in franchise history. No Jays playoff team averaged more runs or homers, but the 2022 version with Guerrero, Bichette, and Teoscar Hernandez produced a better OPS plus and WRC plus. Blasphemy, we know. The starting rotation. The Jays' first playoff team in 1985 American League East champion had the topper-forming starting rotation. Steeb won the ERA title at 2.48 ERA, while Doyle, Alexander, Jimmy Key, and Jim Clancy all checked in at 3.78 or below. The 1985 rotation's 3.32 ERA remains the lowest in franchise history, just ahead of the 1991 team that featured Juan Guzman, Todd Sotomayor, David Wells, Tom Condiotti, and Key. You knew when they went out there that most of those guys were strike throwers, said Hall of Famer Pat Gillick, the Jays general manager from 1977 to 1994. Steve was a strike thrower. Key was a strike thrower. Everybody threw strikes, so you knew that you were going to get innings out of them. Maybe there were other rotations where there was one or two that stuck out, but that was probably the most consistent starting rotation we had. A useful stat to compare one decade to the next is ERA minus, which adjusts a pitcher's ERA to account for ballparks and league averages. The lower the number, the better it is, and the 85 and 91 teams occupy the top two spots in that category as well. More recently, the 2016 rotation, led by league ERA champ Aaron Sanchez, 20-game winner J.A. Happ, and Marco Estrada, stands out with an ERA minus of 87 that ranks third. This year's rotation has a lot of big names, but it doesn't come close to matching the performances of other playoff teams. Their 4.34 ERA is lower than only 1993, which is 4.63, and the COVID abbreviated 2020 season 4.55. The advanced stats tell a similar story, as the current rotation ranks last with a 106 ERA minus. 20 teams in the majors performed better this season. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The bullpen. The bullpen has been a noticeable weakness for most of 2025, so it should come as no surprise that this group doesn't stack up well. Just like the starters, the bullpen's ERA minus of 103 is the highest of any Jays team that qualified for the postseason. The best year, once again, was 1985, when Bill Caudill, Dennis Lamp, Jim Acker, Tom Henke, and others put up a 78. It's one of the greatest teams I ever played on, Henke, a Jay from 1985 to 92, told the Star from his farm in Missouri. Dennis was undefeated that year, 110. Jim was just a solid middle guy, long guy, with Dennis, and Gary Lavelle was just lights out from the left side. Henke joined the team in August, stepped into the closer's role almost immediately, and posted a 2.03 ERA with 13 saves and 14 opportunities. The second best pen was in 1991, when Henke, Dwayne Ward, and Mike Timlin contributed to an 85. Perhaps the biggest surprise is that the third lowest was in 2023, when Jordan Romano, Yimi Garcia, Tim Mizea, Eric Swanson, and others combined for an 89. Even though this season's closer, Jeff Hoffman, has made headlines for blowing a lot of saves, there have been playoff years that were worse. The most blown saves by a Jays playoff team was 27 in 2022. The 1985 team, despite the low ERA, is tied for third with 23, the same number as this season. The best was the 92 team with only 10 blown saves. "We had a great bullpen," said Henke, who was good on 34 of 37 chances that year. Dwayne Ward and myself, David Wells, Mike Timlin, we had a lot of talent down there. What it all means. The franchise record for wins is 99, set in 1985. That team, in addition to having an elite pitching staff, rolled out Bell, Mosby, Barfield, and Tony Fernandez in the everyday lineup. It's fitting that version has possession of the top spot because it also ranks first among the playoff teams in wins above replacement with 50.7. The second highest WAR belongs to the 2015 division winners, 47.9, while the 93 World Series champs were third at 47.8. What's interesting about WAR is that the 2021 Jays, who were eliminated on the final day of the regular season, had an even higher 52.6. So did the 1987 team, 52.5, that lost its final seven games to miss the playoffs. Only four times in franchise history have the Jays finished with more regular season wins than this year's 94. However, 2025 standing among all those clubs is a bit lower. Manager John Schneider's squad possessed a top five offense, but season-long pitching struggles have had a negative impact on how they will be viewed long-term. Their 42.9 WAR is better than only 1989, excluding the abbreviated 2020 campaign. It's hard to argue with the 1992-93 teams, but the 85 team had 99 wins and was probably the best, said Buck Martinez, who was a Jays catcher that year and a broadcaster for every other playoff run. Former manager Bobby Cox also said the 83 and 84 teams were great teams without a closer. In 85, Henke showed up and it made a big difference. But I'll put this year's team, its personality, character, and willingness to win against any team in franchise history. I think they have the belief that they can play with anybody, and they don't need one or two guys to win games for them. They have a lot of guys who can do that. Of course, when fans look back on the best teams in franchise history, they often think about the playoffs, not the regular season, which makes it difficult to top 92 or 93. The 2025 Jays still have a lot of work to do before they enter that conversation. Province targets portions of bike lanes for removal. Priority sections cover just 900 meters and Young Bloor documents reveal. Premier Doug Ford's government is focused on removing less than a kilometer of bike lanes on Bloor and Young Streets, internal documents show. Briefing documents prepared by Transportation Ministry staff and obtained by the Star via a Freedom of Information request show the Ontario government is prioritizing the removal of bike lanes on Bloor Street West between Resurrection and Clissold Roads and on Young Street between Millwood Road and Merton Street. Those stretches listed as priority removal sections for bike lanes cover a combined 900 meters. The two documents do not outline how the sections of targeted bikeways fit into the Ford government's broader plans for the full 22 kilometers of bike lanes on Bloor Street, Young Street, and University Avenue. A spokesperson for PROBME Sarkaria, Ontario's Minister of Transportation, did not respond to the Star's question about the documents by publication deadline. The briefing documents are dated May 13, 2025, just a few weeks after Superior Court Justice Paul Chabas granted cycling advocates a temporary injunction that prevented the Ford government from moving ahead with the bike lane removals. Chabas would later rule in July that the Ford government's effort to remove bike lanes was unconstitutional. The government launched its appeal a month later. The impact of removing a combined 900 meters of bike lanes is likely to be small, said Maddie Siemiatkowski, director of the University of Toronto's Infrastructure Institute. Removing 900 meters of bike lanes in isolation would have a minimal impact on both traffic congestion, the Ford government's stated reason for their removal, and cycling ridership, experts told the Star. The targeted sections are on the edges of the bike lane network, where cycling ridership is relatively low, explained Maddie Siemiatkowski, director of the University of Toronto's Infrastructure Institute. The impact of removing a combined 900 meters of bike lanes is likely to be small, she added, but added, we wanted to see the data because there could be site-specific bottlenecks. The cost of removals was included as part of the documents, but was redacted to prevent the protect the economic interests of the government. A report from the city staff pegged the cost of removing all of the Bloor, Young, and University bike lanes at $48 million, a cost the province has said it will cover. Ford has dismissed that cost estimate as, quote, hogwash. The documents also indicate that the government may reinstate on-street parking on Young Street in the 400-meter section where the bike lane would be removed. The Bloor Street West section of bike lanes targeted for removal is in the heart of Etobicoke, just west of a collection of local businesses that have been especially vocal about bike lanes and that have gone as far as suing the city and city staff over their installation. The premier and his government campaigned on removing bike lanes in Toronto's downtown core during February's election. The provincial government argued that road space dedicated to cyclists was taking away road space from drivers and that cyclists should instead be diverted to secondary roads. Bike lane users Eva Stranger Ross and Narada Kiando and Cycle Toronto filed a charter challenge with the Superior Court in December, arguing that the new law puts lives at risk. As the court proceedings dragged on throughout the spring and summer, Mayor Olivia Chow sought to find a compromise with the province. Government documents released as part of the injunction hearing warned that removing the bike lanes may not ease congestion and instead could increase the risk of collisions and negatively affect businesses. While the government's appeal of Shabas's ruling is underway, it cannot remove the bike lanes on Bloor University and Yonge Street. Shabas found that parts of the Ford government's bike lane legislation violated the Charter of Rights and Freedoms because it put people at risk. The decision did not guarantee a right to bike lanes, but instead protected cycling infrastructure on the three targeted roads. The government has the right to make decisions about roads and traffic infrastructure, Shabas wrote in his decision. But where the government takes action that puts people at risk and does so arbitrarily, its actions may be restrained by the charter. Just days after Shabas's decision in August, Ford railed against the judge, denouncing the ruling as the worst case of trampling on people's rights I've ever seen, ever seen in the courts, ever. This judge has been attacked by every single person right across the country for this ridiculous decision, Ford said. MPP breaks his silence on spousal assault charge. Rookie MPP Chris Scott, who was removed from Premier Doug Ford's Progressive Conservative Caucus after being charged with spousal assault with a weapon, has broken his silence. The Sault Ste. Marie MPP, now sitting as an independent, issued a statement Thursday, which was first reported by local news outlet Sault Today. I want to address the community directly following recent allegations and questions surrounding my office. I have retained counsel to represent me. I have trust and confidence in the criminal justice system, said Scott, elected as a Tory MPP on February 27th after being handpicked as a candidate by Ford. While the case is before the court, it is inappropriate to comment further about the charges. Out of respect for everyone involved, especially my children, I ask that my family's privacy be respected through this process, he said. I am taking a short leave from partisan and non-essential public appearances, but remain fully committed to serving the people of Sault Ste. Marie as I was elected to do. Constituency services will continue without interruption, and my work as your MPP continues. My office remains open to help residents with casework, government programs, and everyday issues. Scott, 35, was arrested by Toronto police on September 21st after he allegedly assaulted his wife in Sault Ste. Marie 2 days earlier with a child's high chair. The MPP, whose full name is Christopher Allen Winfield Van Scott, was released on $5,000 bail on September 22nd after being charged with assault with a weapon and assault. If convicted, he faces up to 10 years behind bars. He has retained prominent Toronto criminal lawyer Michael Lacey, who has declined to comment on the case. According to documents filed in the Ontario Court of Justice, Scott allegedly used a weapon, to wit, a high chair, contrary to Section 267A of the Criminal Code. None of the charges against him has been tested in court. The married father of three young children is to next appear in court in Sault Ste. Marie on October 22nd. A one-time top aide to Ford, Scott was elected in February after defeating New Democratic challenger Lisa Vezu Allen by just 114 votes. Province amends its regulations for special economic zones. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Premier Doug Ford is amending regulations for his controversial special economic zones after they sparked concerns of overreach from Indigenous communities, environmentalists, and municipalities. Ford touted Bill 5, with its powers to fast-track mining and large infrastructure projects, as the solution to U.S. trade actions against Canada. But after criticism that it overrides local wishes, he is now scrambling to fix it. As we have said all along, regulations to create special economic zones and Indigenous-led special economic zones would be done through consultations with Indigenous communities, said Lachlan Fraser, press secretary for Greg Rickford, the Minister of Indigenous Affairs and First Nations Economic Reconciliation of Ontario. To that end, the governor announced new proposed regulations Thursday that it says will consider Indigenous concerns relayed during recent consultations, although most regulations would offer the minister a wide berth of discretion. Granting the minister the right to opine on multiple decisions risks lobbyist influence and politically based decisions, critics said. NDP leader Marit Stiles said the proposals for Ford's special economic zones should be called no-law zones. These criteria open the door for lobbyists and insiders to cut to the front of the line, Stiles said in a statement. Instead of protecting the public interest, this government is setting up a system that can once again leave the door wide open to reward insiders. When will enough be enough? The problem with granting a politician so much power, said Liberal MPP Ted Hsu, Kingston and the Islands, is that it depends on the minister having a good opinion of what you want to do. And the whole danger of the special economic zones and potential exemption from any law or regulation is that there's a lot of potential for corruption, Hsu said. These regulations have not made me feel any better because it's now solidified. For the second time, they said it all relies on the minister's opinion, the minister's discretion. Green leader Mike Schreiner called the regulations deliberately vague. They're crafted to look like safeguards, but in reality, they do nothing to prevent backroom deals and giveaways to well-connected insiders, now rebranded as trusted proponents, Schreiner said. The government said some of the Indigenous feedback from recent consultations has been incorporated into the new proposed regulations. Other points have not. The draft regulations now reflect analysis of potential environmental and health impacts, along with ways to mitigate risk, government documents said. Feedback still under consideration looks at Indigenous-led proposals or the extent of Indigenous participation in a project. Feedback not reflected includes calls for the recognition of Indigenous people's rights, including treaty rights. Fraser said the outreach began in the summer. We will continue to fulfill our duty to consult and work in true partnership to ensure that projects advance and support Indigenous-led economic prosperity, he said. nothing is going to be easy for Carney. Mark Carney was presented back in June with two emotional support chickens, the creation of an Edmonton Oilers fan and crochet artist to help fans of the hockey team deal with playoff stress. They give you something to hold on to while you're trying to make it through overtime without having a heart attack, said Ashley Sinclair, the creator, who admitted to being gobsmacked when she saw photos of Carney tossing around the chickens. The Edmonton Oilers aren't anywhere near the Stanley Cup yet, but Carney may want to haul the chickens out again to help get him through the next 4 to 6 weeks. Though the Prime Minister would likely say that nothing in his job has been easy since he took it on this year, this next month is throwing him into multiple games of chicken. Presiding over a minority parliament always brings its share of chicken games, but the November 4th budget is looming, and Carney is holding meetings with opposition leaders this week, looking for the handful of votes the Liberals need to get it passed. It's a confidence vote, so the stakes are high for all the parties who have to stare down the prospect of throwing the country into another election. Think that can't happen so soon after the last one? That's what Joe Clark and his progressive conservatives thought too in 1979 when their budget crashed and Canada turned around and put Liberals back in power in early 1980. Some might argue that it wouldn't be the worst thing for Carney if he had to go back to the polls. But the latest Abacus survey shared that the Star on Thursday shows conservatives and liberals in a dead heat. 40% support for Pierre Poilievre's team, 41% for Carney's. Abacus CEO David Coletto says some of the underlying data in this latest poll shows positive perceptions of Carney are starting to shift. The poll was conducted online among 1,504 Canadians over the past week. And while margin of error can't be calculated for this type of survey, a similar size survey would be considered accurate within 2.53 percentage points, 19 times out of 20. What it means is that no one is likely looking for an election, least of all the new Democratic Party, with just 7 seats, still in slumping poll support, and just getting a leadership campaign underway. Carney met with interim NDP leader Don Davies on Wednesday, and judging from Davies' statement in the Commons on Thursday, some hard lines were set down. "Now is not the time for an austerity budget," Davies said. "Canada needs investment, not cuts. That means building infrastructure to strengthen communities, affordable, non-market homes, clean energy, and a strong public health care system. These are the kind of nation-building projects New Democrats support." Meanwhile, though, those nation-building projects are quickly evolving into another game of chicken. Carney has said to expect another round of announcements around the Grey Cup, which comes mid-November. Sorry for all the sports references here, but that's how things roll in Ottawa these days. As my colleague Althea Raj wrote this week, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith stepped up the pressure on Carney with her proposal for a new bitumen pipeline to be built to the British Columbia coast, an idea that will run up against resistance in British Columbia. She made it very clear that she was daring Carney to turn her down. "This is a test of whether Canada works as a country," Smith said. As Raj reported, citing several caucus sources, Carney played down the prospect of a pipeline when he met with MPs on Wednesday. Little wonder he does not need to play yet another game of chicken with the nervous environmentalists in his own ranks. Of course, there's someone else out there who keeps wanting to test whether Canada works as a country, and that's Donald Trump. Just this week, the U.S. president was talking about his Golden Dome missile defense dream and said Canada wanted to be part of it, to which I said, "Well, why don't you just join our country, become 51, become the 51st state, and you get it for free." Premier Doug Ford said the comment drove him crazy. Trump didn't elaborate on who had called him about the Golden Dome, whether it was Carney himself, for instance. If so, what does Carney say when Trump brings this up? Does he shake his head and say never, never, as he did at the White House earlier this year? The trade talks with the U.S. aren't building to the same looming deadlines as the budget and the major projects test imposed by Smith, but Trump is always looking for someone to blink. Carney may need a few more of those emotional support chickens. Crown will seek doctor recordings. Babysitter's manslaughter trial halted as court weighs ordering mother to hand over secret audio. A collection of audio recordings of doctors secretly made by the mother of a dead toddler will be sought by the Crown attorney prosecuting the case, a London, Ontario court heard Thursday. Meredith Gardner told court she will be seeking a production order, a judicial authorization ordering someone to turn over written or electronic information, to require the mother, Roseanne Vanderweel, to hand over the audio recording. Roughly a year following her son Nathaniel McClellan's death, Vanderweel recorded meetings she had with several doctors who had treated him. This news brought the on-again, off-again trial of the toddler's babysitter to a halt midday. Justice Michael Carnegie has adjourned the trial with a plan to schedule the next dates on Monday. To date, the trial has heard 9 days of testimony and cross-examination from one witness, Vanderweel. Former babysitter Megan Van Hoof, who ran an unlicensed daycare in Strathroy, is on trial for manslaughter in the October 31, 2015 death of 15-month Nathaniel. Court has heard that Van Hoof was caring for the baby at her home. He became unwell, and she telephoned Vanderweel, who picked him up and rushed him to hospital. The cause of death was blunt force trauma. Throughout Vanderweel's testimony, there have been references to audio recordings she made of an undisclosed number of meetings she had with doctors. As the Star has reported previously, Vanderweel met with doctors, pediatric specialists, emergency room physicians, and a child abuse specialist, and recorded them surreptitiously with her iPhone. Vanderweel has told the court she did this to help her remember key details she needed in order to understand what had happened to her son. She testified that after an earlier non-recorded meeting with a doctor, she decided to record subsequent meetings. I began to realize that it was a lot of information and I didn't understand it all fully, so the next meeting I did record it so I could be better. Excerpts from those recordings were included in Death in a Small Town, the Toronto Star podcast on the case, which was aired in 2022. Previously, the Crown sought a production order against the Star to hand over material, the scope of which included the audio recordings Vanderweel made of the doctors. A court denied the Crown's application. Court heard this week that Vanderweel has never provided the recordings to police or prosecutors. An email sent earlier to Vanderweel, a Crown witness, received no response, said Gardner. The Crown attorney began Thursday's court hearing by announcing she would seek the judicial production order to get the audio files. A judge will determine if they must be handed over. Asked why she would not turn them over, Vanderweel had two answers. Initially, when police considered her a suspect in her son's death, she said she had lost faith in the police. Now, after the lengthy cross-examination in the trial, she had a different reason. Because I've seen how my words were twisted in this experience, and I am not going to. Vanderweel said, it is her understanding that the doctors she recorded will be testifying in the trial. There is nothing that they said to me that they wouldn't say in court. They're professional, Vanderweel said. Defense lawyer Jeff Snow has suggested to Vanderweel that she does not want to hand over the recordings because they would undermine her view of what happened to her son. Vanderweel denied that allegation. At one point on Thursday, Snow seemed to suggest that the trial should be stopped altogether since he did not have the doctor's recordings when he cross-examined Vanderweel. After discussions in court, a decision was made to adjourn court pending the outcome of the production order. Snow, who has said the recordings could cause real prejudice, said he needs time to consider the ramifications of the recordings becoming evidence. Justice Carnegie will have a brief hearing with the lawyers Monday to set dates for resumption of the trial. Due to various scheduling conflicts, the earliest dates being discussed are in December. Nathaniel's story was also the subject of a 2021 narrative series in The Star. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the today's issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Linda Lover. Thank you for listening.